We put on our cowboy hats and running shoes and race to win the heart of a beautiful maiden. Learn about the beloved Sega Genesis game Dash and Desperados from Data East on this episode of Sega Talk.
SegaBits presents Sega Talk, a podcast talking all things
Sega!
With your hosts, George and Barry.
Look, it's a giant talking egg. I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to the master here. So what?
Hello, howdy y'all, and welcome to Sega Talk number 131. Data East and Dash and Desperados. I'm Barry, and with me is my cowpoke, George.
Hello, everyone.
George, you gotta try harder than that. Let me hear you say, woohoo, yahoo.
Woohoo, yahoo.
Is that what cowboys say? I don't know.
It sounds like what Mario would say, right?
Woohoo, I'm a cowboy. Yeah, I didn't really practice my cowboy before all this. But in any case, yeah, welcome to Sega Talk. This is the brand new, extremely excited Barry. People have commented and said, Barry didn't really seem into that game. But you know what? I will be into every single game from here on out because I'm taking drugs, illegal
what?
Drugs to keep me... No, I'm just kidding. But this is the Wild West, and I'm a desperado, and we got to do to get by. But George, before we get into the episode, before we get into the Patreon plugs and everything... And I know these episodes are usually evergreen, but the people are dying to know, what are your thoughts on the Game Awards reveal of those five games?
Oh, the Sega games, right?
Yeah, give us,
yeah,
give us like a 30
second, they were pretty
George.
Awesome. The Crazy Taxi one, I think, is the most interesting with the gameplay that we've seen so far with the cops and like different types of modes and online things. The other ones, I don't know what to think of until I actually see more gameplay, but they look good.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. All right, well, people have heard what I have to say, and they said I didn't sound as excited as I should have been, but I don't know, like, I we knew about half of those games, and the other half are kind of like, oh, cool, Shinobi from Lizard Cube, that makes sense, you know, it's just like, obviously.
It looks amazing, though, the graphics.
It does look amazing, and I was called out, I was like, they just made a Shinobi game, people were like, Barry, the 3DS game was over a decade ago, and I'm like, I was like... the Saving Private Ryan gif of him just like aging 40 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so this Sega Talk is supported by Patreon supporters. And this specific episode was actually supported by Patreon picker Nicholas Schaefer. George, why don't you give us the backstory on how Nicholas picked this episode? Like, what did he do? How did he do that?
So he went to this website called patreon.com/SegaBits. On there, you can see our different tiers to support the show. $20 tier lets you pick your own episode, like Dashing Desperados. So check us out and support the show. Thanks.
Hell yeah. So, yeah, Dashing Desperados. This is a game we wouldn't have picked, but Nicholas picked it. This is a Nick pick. So let's hear Nicholas's memories at the top of the show before we dive in to talking about the game. So I knew there was a story behind it because no one just picks this game out of nowhere. This isn't like a Shenmue 2. So why did he pick this game? Well, he said, I love this game and only got it by chance. I picked up my third Genesis at a yard sale for $25 with two controllers and five games. Most of the games were sports games. This is how I got Wonder Boy and Toy Story 2. Maybe he means Toy Story 1. I don't think 2 was on. Anyway, other games I enjoyed. But this game was really worth the $25 all on its own. I spent hours with my friends playing two-player platformer racing. And unlike Sonic multiplayer, this game was built from the ground up for it. And you could tell. Out of all the Genesis games I owned, this was the game that got the other kids who owned PlayStation and N64 to come to my house. And what I love is we all have so much fond memories of it, and yet it is a hidden gem because nobody talks about it. Well, guess what, Nicholas? Barry and George are talking about it. So,
yeah.
Lucky you. So let's talk about Dashin' Desperados. It was released September 93 for the Sega Genesis. It's a platforming and racing game developed by Data East and released exclusively in North America. The game is said to be a spin-off of the game Spin Master, and interestingly, when you play it on a Japanese Mega Drive, the title screen changes to be titled Rumble Kids. However, no official Japanese version ever existed, and just to set the record straight, so the game Spin Master, it was an arcade game released December 1993, so supposedly after Dashin' Desperados, so wouldn't that make that the spin-off?
Right.
Anyway, and that was released to the SNK Neo Geo MVS hardware. It was actually Data East's first game developed on that hardware. And I'd like to say more about the game, but honestly, from what I looked at, outside of similar art styles and both containing platforming, there are very few connections to Spin Master and Dashin' Desperados. The game doesn't even, at least from what I could tell, share creative staff. So I feel like this might be something that people kept putting in wikis and then it became true. I mean, this isn't like Rystar and Sonic 3 having a lot of connective tissue. This is more like, I don't know, like Zool and Sonic. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe that's a bad comparison. Those are different companies. But like, anyway, let's put those guys out there. On first glance, what do you think of Dashin' Desperados, and which title do you prefer more, Dashin' Desperados or Rumble Kids?
So I think based on the art style of these two games, like when you think of Dashin' Desperados, you think of like a like Red Dead Redemption type graphical look or Sunset Riders type of Desperado look. But this is actually more of a kiddie anime chibi look, which would probably fall more under Rumble Kids as a art style.
Right.
If you had to have both names. As far as the game, very interesting. I've never heard of this game before, so I heard. So this is very like niche title. I don't know if you've heard it before this episode, but I think it's interesting that they made a whole game based on the Sonic 2, basically racing.
But yeah, better.
Even some of the art levels kind of look like Sonic 2 levels.
A little bit, yeah. And you know, it's interesting you mentioned that because yeah, it's like they took something that they saw as popular in Sonic 2, and they're like, let's just make that a whole game. And I mean, and we'll get into it later, but this type of game is also something we've seen before, but it's much more arcade based. And the fact that this actually isn't an arcade conversion of something is surprising, because if you were to tell me, yeah, Dashin' Desperados was a really popular Japanese arcade game, I believe you, but it's not the case. As far as the name, what I learned from just this episode is Desperados ends with an E, which is so weird to me, like the plural is D-O-E-S. I misspelled it throughout the notes until I was like making the graphic, and I was like, that's funny. Dashin's like spelled intentionally wrong, and then Desperados looks wrong. I thought it was like an Inglorious Bastards situation, but I looked it up and I'm like, no, that's it. So story. Let's take a look at the story as told by the instruction manual. So they wrote, "Are you ready for a reckless race that's like nothing you've ever experienced? Dashin' Desperados pits you against a friend or the computer in a split-screen speed contest that puts a whole new perspective on getting ahead. Will and Rick, a couple of cool cow dudes, were best buds until Jenny came to town. They've been rivals ever since, competing constantly for her attention. Now Jenny's dad has given her a trip around the world for her birthday. Will and Rick are both determined to go along as her bodyguard, and they'll do anything to top even each other. Wait, to top even each other. Okay. From the deserts of the Southwest to the icebergs of the Arctic, through shark-infested seas and haunted ruins, you'll need to your fastest footwork, your wits, and a few handy bombs to keep Jenny safe and sound, and to leave your opponent in the dust. So you'd better get dashing, Desperados, and may the coolest cow dude win." And just so you know, the definition of desperado, it is a desperate or reckless person especially a criminal. So they hired two desperate, reckless criminals to bodyguard his daughter, but they're right. also trying to kill each other to, like, get with her.
Right, which is a weird story. Like, the whole idea that she's put up for a trophy for two hardened criminal men to
right.
beat their way towards her is kind of a weird story, obviously. Very 90s, sadly, but, I mean, it is kind of aged, but besides yeah. that, I think it's trying to be silly, obviously.
Well, for sure, yeah. I'm surprised they're not, like, trying to get gold, though. Like, gold right. rush instead of, like...
A girl? Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It would have been made more sense that way for sure. Like a gold or some sort of heist, and they're trying to race towards the heist would have made more sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
now,
for sure.
What's your general opinion of like cowboy and Wild West video games, like up to the 90s and then since then? Like how have you seen it change, and do you have any favorites?
I think we've talked about this a little different, but yeah, like obviously I like them a lot. I think have one for every like era, obviously. Gunsmoke for the NES era, which is also in arcades. Sunset Riders, and I would guess they had Gun in the 2000s. I don't even remember that game. That one's alright.
Yeah, I remember that.
And then obviously Red Dead Redemption games are obviously yeah. the top now. I guess before they were more arcadey, now they're more... Like, especially Red Dead Redemption is now a simulator. It's kind of like the be-all, end-all of Western games in a way.
Right. Yeah, you know, cowboy games up until, like, the 90s were the go-to for anything involving light guns or shooting.
Mm-hmm.
There was that game that became famous in Back to the Future Part 2, that Nintendo arcade one where you're shooting outlaws. And then you mentioned Sunset Riders. Was that the light gun one? I'm blanking.
That's the side scrolling.
That's
Konami
Lethal Enforcers, right?
Right.
Yeah. And then, it seems like it's either light gun games, anything having to do with shooting. So I'm actually surprised this is a cowboy game that's not focused on shooting at all. Really, it's more running. So these guys could have been anything. They didn't need to be cowboys, especially since the game's not like stuck in the Old West. But yeah, it seems like as time went on, especially in the 2000s, cowboy games matured, they became more edgy, and then I think things really met their peak with Red Dead Redemption, which of course was a sequel to Red Dead Revolver, which was kind of popular, but yeah, I think even RDR2 like outdid the first Red Dead Redemption. In fact, I worked with a guy, and he was like, you know, super clean cut, neat looking guy. His desk was like immaculate. I didn't take him for a video gamer, and then he overheard that I like video games, and he was like, "Oh, do you have any recommendations?" I'm like, "Oh, I just started playing Red Dead Redemption." He goes, "Oh, cool, I'll check it out." And in like a month, he not only 100%ed the game, but like probably put in about a month's worth of gameplay and became right. like addicted to it. And he was like, "Have you finished it yet?" And I'm like, "Honestly, dude, I played 2 hours of it and I stopped."
Right.
So it's like, wow. But yeah, that game became an obsession, especially the sequel during the pandemic. There were people like living Second Life, basically raising horses, killing them, you know,
all the good wild. Stuff of being a cowboy.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is definitely the sillier end of the cowboy spectrum. And you mentioned the gameplay. It is very much like Sonic 2's two-player mode turned into its own game. I also saw that it's similar to Sega's Alex Kidd, The Lost Stars, especially the arcade version where you had Alex and Stella, I believe her name is.
Mm-hmm.
Boy and girl kind of navigating their way through. So yeah, you pick one of two cowboys, Will or Rick, Will being, I believe, player one, Rick player two, and you run your way through various obstacles to reach Jenny. Whoever gets her first gets a kiss and wins the stage. It's presented in split screen regardless of if you're playing a single player or two player game. Players move from left to right and squat down, as well as jump, pressing the jump button, or hopping by holding the jump button. And players can also drop down from platforms, you know, pretty... We're used to that. You hold down, press jump. But the big thing is that You can not only use weapons and items, but you can perform a rolling dash by pressing a dedicated button that I'm going to call a boost button, because it gives you a burst of speed. So it's modern Sonic's boost, predated by like a good solid decade and a half. The good news is this game is not, I mean, I've heard it's difficult, but it's not impossible. So despite all these hazards and enemies, players are invulnerable, and hazards only slow you down. They don't kill you, so you don't have to... Like, my big complaint for Alex Kidd and the Lost Stars is it's so easy to die. I think it's like one-hit deaths. So, you know, you're dying constantly. So, yeah, comparing this game to Sonic 2 or the Lost Stars, how do you think this game sounds, like, conceptually and maybe even difficulty-wise?
I mean, obviously, no dying by getting hit with hazards makes the game way more easy, and it's more about the race, really, and trying to get before the other player, right? Than it is more about the difficulty of the hazards on the stage. It's just
right.
So I would say a lot easier on this game for sure, and I think this would probably be more enjoyable for multiplayer people, considering that, like, when you have your cousin over that doesn't really play that many video games, you don't want to be dying and losing lives and continuing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's from what I've heard, the CPU is really difficult, and we'll get into why. But if you're playing it with two players, especially if you have someone who has, you know, skill issues, they're not that good, you're going to play through the whole game, which is kind of cool. You're going to get to see every level. They're just going to be upset that they keep losing to you. But at least they're not dying constantly, which is always difficult. I've noticed those Kirby games, Epic Yarn, are great for kids, because I don't think you actually really die, or at least you respawn without any difficulty. But yeah, what do you think about Data East having a cowboy game in the early 90s beating Sonic's boost button?
I think that's it's like interesting, right? When you always see these little mechanics that you're like, oh, it was in this game, whatever,
right.
And it never got incorporated into a Sonic game until, yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I think the first time he boosted was, I think, Sonic Rush, like, in the early 2000s. So yeah, 10 years later. In the single-player experience, players control Will and race Rick, who's basically the game's enemy. After completing each world, Jenny is kidnapped by Rick, who attempts to take her away, and Will must destroy Rick's vehicle before he escapes. Rick will also make things easy for the player by waiting at certain points if he gets too far ahead. However, he can also catch up very quickly, like too quick, if he falls too far behind. So, do you find this kind of CPU-controlled character to be fair, or would you prefer a CPU player that just plays normally and doesn't wait or speed up?
Probably. I don't know. That's a hard one. What would you prefer?
Yeah, it's like it helps you in one case because it stops.
Right.
And I'm trying to think of, because I always compare things to like Sonic of this era. I feel like there were like Sonic games where like the character would wait, like Knuckles would be standing there.
Right.
And then once you get close, he starts going again. But I appreciate that, but then it must be really frustrating when you're doing really well and you see them suddenly moving a lot faster than anyone's able to actually move when playing the game. So I don't know. I don't know what that term is.
Rubber banding, I think they call it.
Is that really rubber banding? Yeah, so it's like it always kind of keeps the player in check. So it's like you can suck at this game, but it gives you a little lead. But you can also be really good at this game and it punishes you. So it's like, I don't know. And I have to wonder if it's just the AI or whatever they use is just not that smart.
Mm-hmm.
So the alternative would just be a opponent just going through a pre-designed like movements, but then they're not fighting you.
Right.
I don't know. So in two-player games, the second player plays as Rick, and both players race through the same worlds as the single-player game, but levels are a little different. So some levels race to Jenny, but there are also levels to retrieve an item that you must return to Jenny, or levels where you must collect a certain item within the level. Levels are designed so that the high path is clearer but harder to stay on, and the bottom has more dangers. So, I mean, again, comparisons to Sonic, this is very much something they do in Sonic stages, where the top portion's easier to make your way through than the bottom. Do you see any other comparisons here to, like, Genesis-era games that you've played?
I'm trying to think. Obviously, we already said the look of Alex Kidd. Mean, obviously, the character design says... So, not really. I think, to me, those are the games that most... the menu system or whatever and the lettering reminds me of, like, Super Mario for some reason. But besides that, that's it.
Yeah, the menus and the UI and everything really feel like something very much not Sega. It seems like something you'd see on a Super NES game.
Right.
The weapons, though. Let's take a look at the weapons here. So... Or I should say the items. So the game has items you throw, and these include bombs. So that's fitting for cowboys. Fire, which feels very much like something out of Adventure Island, I think. You throw like little fire sticks. Thunder, which looks like a light bulb. So this allows you to bounce twice along the ground before exploding and shocking the opponent, which is kind of cool. So you're like... whole body becomes a weapon. Energy rolls around the ground and shocks opponents, so it's almost like a Street Fighter move. Freeze is a little snowman. It slides along the ground and freezes the opponent. Barbell is a large projectile that flattens opponents. And then Special is a bomb given for boss fights. And it looks like a underwater mine, almost. But... just speaking of cowboys, none of these scream cowboy to you, do they?
No, not really. They just look like generic moves. Like, it could be on any game.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little disappointing. And then when you get into the power-ups, like Chicken Leg, that's just, like, obviously. that you know, I feel like we could do a whole episode on games with chicken legs in them, and we'd be here for 3 hours. These fully restore the character's dashing power meter. Speed boots, which are very much a cowboy thing, they increase the character's running speed. Invisible potion makes the character invisible. Bonus coin gives the player 5,000 points. Honeycomb, it's like another potion. It releases a bee that tries to sting the other character. Huh. And then Thundercloud releases a Thundercloud that chases the other character and shoots lightning at them. So I'm presuming these are things, having played the game, you touch them and they just do their thing. They're not something you hold on to. But again, like looking at the design of them, very non-cowboy. The idea of potions is a little weird. The idea that the bee attack is a green vial... like, what?
Right. It doesn't make any sense.
I don't know. So, like, another notable game, at least in my head, that has really confusing items is Sonic and Sega All-Stars Racing. And even the sequel. In that case, it was like, you could have drawn from every single Sega game, and instead you pick, like, Boxing Glove. Like, it makes no sense. But here, it's very clearly a game inspired by, like, running cowboys and... you maybe get two items, the boots and the bomb, maybe the bomb. But, like, again, I don't know. The theme here is kind of weak. The potions are a really weird choice. I'm not trying to be down on it, but it's just, like, if I can criticize the game, it's this, like, randomness to it. I don't know. And also, like I mentioned, like, your weapons are projectiles. So that's it. You don't get guns. This isn't, like, Contra or I'm blanking. What's that other one? The Neo Geo run and gun kind of game.
Metal Slug?
Yeah, it's not like Metal Slug. Like they could have gone all out. What are your thoughts? Like, do you think this game could have used like guns and more cowboy play?
It looked like they got these power ups from another game they were making and they just like plopped them up in here. Like they have a potion and then like a green potion. And it's just like a recolor. They didn't have enough time. So it's like, it feels very weird, the power-ups.
And speaking of weird, let's get into the levels here. So I actually, let me see if I can pull up the manual on my end, because the manual actually says a little more about the levels than the wiki does, but we can look at the pictures here. So the first level is town. So Will and Rick are taking to the streets of their town. So you're in the West, I guess, right now. In a foot race to reach Jenny. And you smash moles and fetch a gift for your beloved Jenny. But watch out for mean neighbors, dogs, and swaggering crows. So this is like said to be their town, but it doesn't really look like a Wild West town. It looks like a city. Interesting. World 2 is the wilderness. This is like the peak cowboy level. But they call it the wilderness. I would have said this is where they're from. I mean, it's cowboy territory. You fight mice, scorpions, rolling stones, and hungry vultures. And your fetch quest, if you're doing two-player, is to bring back Jenny's water bottle. That's nice. Now, remember, it's an around-the-world plot, so now we're in the ocean. So Jenny's dad's like, we're going to go around the world. What's the first continent you want to go to? And she's like, Africa? And he goes, no, bottom of the ocean. So this is a surf and destroy mission. You race through the wild waves, jumping onto surfboards, riding in rowboats, avoiding dangerous whirlpools, flying fish, hermit crabs, sharks, and octopi. You collect pearls for Jenny and pick up treasures along the way and bring back Jenny's lunchbox to the starting point. So what do you think of that? Jenny's lunchbox is at the bottom of the ocean.
Seems very weird what place to put your lunchbox at.
It's a very weird game in general, right? Super random here. It gets weirder with the jungle. So you got cowboys in the jungle now. Look out for the rolling monkeys and piranhas to move faster. Let the birds carry you off. Get Jenny's necklace back from the little monkey thief and save Jenny from the big monkey to win this world. And I'll just say it right now, like Dash and Desperados, like this game specifically, feels like it should have been the sequel to an all cowboy game where it's like the sequel's like World Tour. Like Rampage did that. Rampage was like America, and then they did the sequel and it was the world. This one's just like, do you guys want to do an all cowboy game? Nah, let's do the world tour of Jenny and her dad, I guess. The next one's called Iceberg. So you think penguins are cute? Think again. These are mean birds here, and even worse, the monkeys throw ice. So there's monkeys in the Arctic. I guess they came with you from the jungle, or they just started running out of assets and they began to reuse them. Be careful. Hidden obstacles will slow you down. Jump on sleds, but watch out for the slippery ice and the freezing ponds. Get Jenny's necklace back from the vicious seagull. So again, like another necklace fetch quest. It's starting to get a little repetitive by the fifth level. And then bring her flowers to show her you're her main man.
Okay.
World 6, last world, is ruins. Do you believe in ghosts? You may bump into ghosts hiding in old pots, be laughed at by skeletons, or get toasted by underwater volcanoes. As you collect treasures to bring to Jenny. Find secret passages, smash the skeletons, and run as fast as you can to win the game. So, what do you think of those stages? Just in concept alone, not artwork or anything.
I feel like they're just all over the place, and they feel more like if I took out the characters and I'm like, these are a Sonic the Hedgehog multiplayer game. And,
right.
And you'd be like, some of these are very believable, especially the ruins or the, the ocean stage. So it's like, okay, it doesn't feel like a cowboy game for sure. It feels like a average platformer game that has cowboys in it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And the art style, though, it's very nice. It actually reminds me of Quackshot. It has a very like Sega Disney game vibe, especially you look at that wilderness. That looks straight out of Quackshot. So does the town one, like Duckburg and I think you go to Egypt. And there's birds that pick you up just like that. They look just like that. Ocean looks very much like Adventure Island. Jungle is actually very Sonic-y. It looks like a lost Sonic stage. And so does Iceberg. It has very Sonic 3 kind of vibes to it, with Ice Cap, maybe. I could have sworn there is a 2D Sonic game with snowmen. Isn't there? Oh, it's an enemy. It's like a robotic snowman. And then finally, The Ruins looks like it's straight out of Quackshot again. So, I mean, I'm not complaining. I think the art style looks really nice. But, yeah, I mean, overall, just visually, it's a very pretty game. Conceptually, it's a little weird, but, you know, I guess the cowboy concept would get old if it was the entire game, but just as someone who didn't, like, grow up with this game and is not super nostalgic about it, I'm, like, a little confused. Not put off, but just kind of like, huh. You decided to do that. Okay. The game also has bonus games, which is really cool. So, bonus mini-games can be played by starting the two-player game and entering certain passwords. And I feel like this is something they put in there for, like, the gaming magazines. And I have to wonder, and I wonder what your thoughts are on this, if developers would intentionally make games with, like, hidden code secrets so they could get press coverage in, like, Nintendo Power and Sega Visions and, like, GamePro. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that would make sense, especially back in the day where people actually went out and bought magazines and bought games based on it. Like, how many games growing up did you buy based on a review from the Dreamcast magazine or coverage?
Oh, I mean, tons with that. And, you know, there were times when I'd be at, like, the store and I'd see a video game magazine. It would have, like, codes. And I'm like, oh. And I'd, like, ask my mom if I could borrow a pen and a piece of paper. And I'd copy some down. But, like, here, you could enter the word rock. And you get a rock falling bonus stage. You enter the word UFO. And you get a UFO, like, chase stage, I guess. You're avoiding them. And then there's two more UFO stages, which is actually kind of cool. So Mine A and Mine B unlock stages where you don't play as the cowboys. You play as the UFO from the UFO stage. And it's basically like battle bots, I guess. So yeah, I mean, it's clear that they just had extra assets and they're like, let's make more fun stuff. And I appreciate that. It kind of reminds me, I don't know if you remember when they did this, but in Rayman 2, there was a DLC where you could play as the letters from the like high score and menu stages. So it's like they took the letters from the menu and made them into a shooting game, which is really weird. But I don't know. I appreciate that. What are your thoughts on these little bonuses?
I feel like developers are just like missing around sometimes, and then they're like doing little tests. Like, you know how when you start actually developing a stage and you're just messing around with things, and I feel like they made them into little password mini games that they would obviously, like you said, give out to magazines to promote the game as a secret. Hopefully get people talking about it. So yeah, I like them. I think they're interesting. I don't know. I think
so.
Now we don't get this kind of stuff. This would all be DLC that you would buy full fledged.
I feel like the last time I saw something like this was like in the kind of recent Wolfenstein, maybe like 5 years ago, where there was a remake of the original Wolfenstein first stage within the game. They didn't have to do that, but it was like they just did, and it was so cool. But I'd like to see more of that. Like when Sonic Frontiers came out, I was speculating, oh, wouldn't it be cool if there was like a hidden area that was like a remake of the map from Sonic Jam's Sonic World. Like, it wouldn't take much time. You'd have a little floating thing and like some little... They never did that. It would have been fun, but whatever. So I guess this kind of wraps it up on at least Dash and Desperados. We got a little more to say about Data East, but based on what we've seen, what's your opinion on the game? And would you add this to your Genesis library if you had the chance?
Yeah, I would add it because I like the graphics. I like the concept. I think it's interesting technology to be able to have two players play simultaneously together and watch them like be able to complete the different... Because in Sonic 2, it was a little weird, like the aspect ratio. This one looks a lot more clear. Yeah. It's more fleshed out. If you like that idea and you actually like the multiplayer of Sonic 2, then I would probably, you know, obviously check this out. But it's kind of what it reminds me of. It's like a full-fledged Sonic 2 better done racing game for multiplayer. So yeah.
Yeah, and it's cool too that the single and multiplayer state games are different.
Right.
Like they have different layouts, different objectives. It actually kind of reminds me of the recently released Sonic Superstars, where single-player mode offers you something, but then multiplayer kind of unlocks certain things that you can't do otherwise. I like when games do that. I like when the single and multiplayer are still the same game, but you get something a little different. As far as the developers of this game, I looked into it. Some names I can call out is the designer Aisuke Tsuwaza, and they designed the game Side Pocket, which is a pool arcade game, and Vapor Trail, which is a top-down shoot-em-up for the Genesis. Programmers Hisetada Oha and Tsuyuji Ishimaki also worked on the games Boulder Dash, Captain America and the Avengers, and the world-famous Minnesota Fats Pool Legend. So suffice to say, while the development team were talented, there's no real breakout industry legends here, and most of the staff either only have Dash and Desperados to their credit, or they worked on a handful of Data East games around the same era. But like, it's not like there's some guy in here, I'm like, oh my god, this guy made, I don't know, Myst.
Right.
mean, a Japanese guy making Myst. But yeah, like, oh, this isn't Yu Suzuki's first game or anything. It's just, it is a game. Yeah, so let's talk about the game's box art. I think this is, I wish I could compare it to other regions, but like I said, this was only in the U.S., not even the British got this, but man, this box art is something else. What do you think about this?
I think it's beautiful. I think this is what every box art should strive to be. Honestly, it's really nightmarish. I don't even know they're trying to copy the cover for Monster World, the old Japanese cover. That's what it feels like, where they're made out of clay. But like, the guy that sculpted the two heroes is like not very good, and it looks horrific. It kind of looks like the Garbage Pail Kids. And then there's like this lady,
Chucky dolls.
And there's this lady that looks like Space Harrier in the back.
Yeah,
what's up with that?
Yeah, she's like, she looks like an adult, and they look like two little Chucky kids.
Right.
It's colorful. It's eye catching. It definitely caught my attention. It's actually surprising because, like you said, this seems like something the Japanese cover art would have, not the American one. I'd expect them just to do a basic, like, painting, you know, like they usually did at this time. It's pretty cool, though. I love the colors. I'd like to think that these exist somewhere, but I'm sure they're long gone. I saw pictures of, like, Nintendo Power cover models recently, and they're just, like, in terrible shape. So yeah, if you're out there and you own the Dash and Desperados statues, let us know. I'd also have to imagine that any other angle, these look ridiculous, because they typically aren't like fully 3D with depth. Like, she's probably actually that big compared to him.
Right.
And their bodies are probably like flat. Like, if you were to turn them around, they'd be like, they look like this, and then you turn around and they're just like little flat guys. Yeah, but it looks cool. And then we also actually have a ad. So this is how the game was marketed. Why don't you read this to us?
I can't. I'm trying to, but I have to like make it smaller for the. Are you ready for a reckless race that's nothing like you ever experienced? Dashing Desperados pits you against a friend or a computer split screen speed contest that puts you in a new perspective on getting ahead. Will and Rick were best buds. Until Jenny came to... Isn't this the same story that we read before?
It is. Yeah, okay. It's pretty much. It's like a rewrite. Like, they changed some things. Now, like, looking at it here, it's nice, though. You get the cover art. You get some screenshots. They very much are playing off of... Look at that. Two players, two screens. Too cool. What other game did that? at the time.
Some Sega games on Genesis called like Sonic the Hedgehog.
Sonic 2, right? Right. Yeah, yeah. And you know what, George? I see a phone number on the bottom, but it's a 900 number, so I'm not calling.
Yeah, don't call
charge
it.
Me.
Yeah, they're going to charge you for the porn. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Be like, sexy ladies want you to chase after them in the Arctic. But yeah, so there you go. The Data East 900 number. If you have 95 cents to spare, give that a call and let us know. But you know, it's not bad. Not the worst ad we've seen. Yeah, that's about wrapped it up. This is the shortest episode in a long time.
Oh yeah.
But no, we'll talk a little bit about Data East. So, George, do you have any strong opinions about Data East, and what comes to your mind when you hear their name?
Captain America and the Avengers, and or, like, Magical Drop, I think, for some reason. I don't know why. I don't think a lot of people even know that name, but that's one that comes to mind. So, you?
Yeah, I looked through all the games I own. Like, I own a ton over there, and I only have 3 Data East related games. So I have this one. It's the most recent I own. It's Data East Arcade Classics for the Wii. I would highly recommend this. It's a great kind of cross section of their games. It has 15 games, and you know, there's Burger Time. That I think Burger Time and Bad Dudes are probably their most well known.
I would agree with that.
There's Side Pocket, which I mentioned, was also worked on by the Dash and Desperados guy. Unfortunately, I don't think Dash and Desperados is actually on here. I have to imagine it's because it's Arcade Classics, and that was a Genesis title. Bad Dudes, that's a popular one. Burnin' Rubber. Caveman Ninja. Express Raider, which is actually another cowboy game from them. And, of course, my favorite, and I actually have the Genesis one here, too, Heavy Barrel is, or the NES one, Heavy Barrel is also on there. Heavy Barrel is actually, I would say, outside of, you know, a lot of the Sega games I talk about, like Ghostbusters, Sonic 2, Dick Tracy, this game I played a shit ton as a kid, specifically this game, because at my grandpa's house, he had an NES that he bought off a neighbor, and that neighbor had a ton of, like, pristine in-box NES games, which he's since given them all to me, but the two I remember always playing were Caveman games and Heavy Barrel, and they're both, like, multiplayer-focused games. Caveman games is really weird, but Heavy Barrel, have you played this game? I absolutely love this game. It's one of my favorite NES games. It's so good. The music's awesome. You're two guys, like two Rambo guys, who are airdropped onto a beach, and it's an over-the-head shooter, but you collect parts. I guess Metal Gear is kind of like that too, right? Like Metal Gear's like the big weapon.
Right.
But the Heavy Barrel is what you're building. So throughout the stage, you'll pick up different pieces of it. And then when you get it, it's like this mega gun that just blasts everyone to shit. But what's so cool is there are tons of like really cool weapons that you can pick up. Some are like giant mines that just swing around you and kill everyone. But yeah, I could keep talking about this. We're never going to do a Sega talk on it because there's no Sega relation. But I absolutely love this game. So I'd recommend checking that out. Either the arcade one or emulating or playing the original NES one. It's so much fun. But yeah, to me, like, that's kind of Data East. It's very arcadey, a lot of two-player game. I feel like two-player is really their bread and butter. I've never really played any like deep single-player Data East games. I don't think they've ever done RPGs or anything.
Right. I can think of either.
Yeah, and you'll figure out why once we get into the history. So, Data East, it was founded by Tetsuo Fukuda on April 20th, 1976 as an electronic engineering company which focused on integrating interchangeable tapes inside arcade game devices, allowing video game operators to replace a game from a machine without having to replace the cabinet itself. Realizing the money that could be made within the interactive content, Data East began developing arcade video games in 1978, starting with their first arcade game, Super Break. Well, they established a U.S. division in 1979 after most of their chief competitors like Sega and Taito had already established a market presence. And at this point, I would say, let's check out gameplay footage of Super Break, but it's actually a clone of Atari's Breakout.
Oh.
So it's hardly the first game to point to as a company. Like, I know Sega's always like, Periscope, and we're like, oh, cool. But imagine if Data East is like, Breakout clone. We'd go, oh, you monsters. Data East released a series of interchangeable systems compatible with their arcade games, notably the Deco cassette system and the multi-conversion kit, but these products soon became infamous among their users due to their numerous technical problems. The company proved to be one of the more successful and long-lasting companies in the business, surviving the U.S. video game crash of 1983 in reasonably good shape and going on to release dozens of games for both arcades and home console systems over the next two decades. By 1985, Data East had shifted away from interchangeability to concentrate themselves on video games only. So, it sounds to me like Data East was just lucky to survive the crash.
Right.
Because we've done an episode on the candy cabinets, Sega's Astro City line.
Mm-hmm.
Those were interchangeable too, but they weren't cassette tapes.
Right.
And I heard about that, and I was going to say, oh, wow, Data East's ahead of their time. That's awesome. But then I read that the products had numerous technical problems. So that explains why we never saw like a huge boom of cassette tape-based
arcade
video
games.
Have you ever played a game on a cassette tape?
No, I didn't even know. I remember when we did a long time ago that interview with the whole, what was the company called?
Oh. Digital Pictures.
Digital Pictures, remember? And then they started off as a digital tape, which is different because it would change the role to different scenes. I thought it was interesting, so I never thought it was possible, but apparently it is a possibility, so that's interesting.
Yeah, I remember there was an angry video game nerd where he had video games on like audio cassette tapes and it loads them onto the computer. Mm. And I know that's a thing, but clearly, those degrade over time. They can get unspooled. It's just like disc-based or chip-based games are just so much more, I don't know, like durable, you know? And in the arcade business, you probably don't want games running off of cassette systems. But Data East, they also made pinball machine tables from 1987 through 1996, acquiring the former factory and assets from Stern Electronics.
Hmm.
The companies created innovations such as the first pinball to have stereo sound, the first usage of small dot matrix display in Checkpoint, along with the first usage of big DMD. You got big DMD energy,
yes,
George?
Of course, always.
And that's in the game Maverick. In designing pinball machines, they showed a strong preference for high-profile but expensive licensed properties rather than creating totally original machines, which did not help the financial difficulties the company began experiencing from 1990 on. So if you're ever at a pinball machine, like, I don't know, place, seek out the Data East ones and see, like, how high-profile their licensees are, because you're going to be kind of astounded by how much money they were dropping. The pinball division was created in 1985 by amidst plummeting sales across the entire pinball market. So not a good time to have the creation of a pinball group when sales are plummeting. Data East chose to exit the pinball business, and guess who they sold their factory to, George? None other than our heroes, Sega, in 1996.
Oh, nice.
And it became Sega Pinball Incorporated, a division of the company. By the end of the 1990s, the company's American division, Data East USA, had been liquidated and Data East had ceased to exist outside of Japan. So yes, that is the twist. This was a Sega Pinball episode all along. No, I'm just kidding. But I would like to do a Sega talk someday on Sega's pinball stuff, because it's, if you listen to the interview I did recently with Ken Horowitz, he did that pinball book that just recently came out. It's just kind of wild that Sega came and went from the pinball business built off of Data East buying an insane amount of licensed titles. That explains why you see like Star Wars Pinball by Sega, X-Files Pinball by Sega, because I think it was kind of coming off of Data East's big license purchasing and Sega buying up the company. What are your thoughts on Data East basically laying the foundation for Sega's pinball?
I mean, it's cool. I'm not a big pinball fan, so I'm never like, yay, pinballs. So I think it's, I guess, pretty all right, but it's outside of my interest in Sega. Like, I'm not nostalgic for the Sega pinball machines. Can you even name one of Sega's pinball machines?
Well, they're all licensed. X-Files, Star Wars.
So they did the Star Wars one, right?
I think they did the Twilight Zone one. I could be wrong.
Okay.
But Ken brought up, too, that Sega was actually in the pinball business in, like, the 70s. So they had machines, and then they got out. And then they went back in, and they got out. And it's interesting, because all this time that Sega had pinball machines, in the 90s, they never thought to make pinball machines based on their games. So they could have done Virtua Fighter pinball, Sonic the Hedgehog pinball. Never did. I don't know why. It's weird. But, you know, Sega, they actually got out of the pinball business, too. So Data East was just, like, not doing too well. I mentioned they had financial problems, so they actually filed for reorganization in 1999 and resumed making video games. So for the following 3.5 years, Data East sold negative ion generators and licensed some of their old games to other companies, and all of this in hope of collecting enough money to be able to make video games again and return to the competition. Nonetheless, the company's restructuring efforts were not enough to put back the financial problems brought by the 90s, and in April 2003, Data East filed for bankruptcy. So 20 years ago this year, Data East was declared bankrupt by a Tokyo District Court, and the news was released to the public 2 weeks later on July 8th. Most of Data East's IP, except for the game's Glory of Heracles, Metal Max, Jake Hunter, and Fighter's History, were acquired in February 2004 by Gmode, a Japanese mobile game content provider, who continue to use the Data East name for smartphone re-releases of Data East's various games. So, you know, we're Sega fans. We've seen our company go through hard times. But man, Data East fans, they were put through the meat grinder. Like, you know, we talk about what happened when the Dreamcast ended. Like, it could have been so much worse, George. We could have been, like, dead and buried like Data East. What are your thoughts on their eventual demise? Did they deserve better?
I mean, a lot of companies from back in the day didn't, like, evolve fast enough, in my opinion, to keep up.
Yeah.
And I think Data East is one of those companies that changed a bit, but it was like, how many of these games that they made can you even call a IP that is known today? Like, SNK has some IPs that people have nostalgia feelings over. And even they're doing kind of, like, rough. Like, they're releasing a bunch of games, but the games are, like, low-selling, and they're making just enough for the next game. So it's interesting. I don't know if any company deserves to fail. I guess if you do bad, I guess you do it. You do. But what is your opinion on this, Barry?
You know, like, if this were their funeral and I was giving the eulogy, I would say, you know, that Data East tried, but ultimately, they failed. They did not have, you know, really any major, I hate to say the word IP, but it really comes down to IP. Like, what intellectual property, what franchises do you have under your belt that can make you relevant for each generation, memorable in people's eyes? And I think they just, they had games there. I mentioned a few, like Burger Time, Bad Dudes, I think they did the Joe and Mac. Like, they have some memorable games, but nothing that jumps out at you to be like franchise worthy or no one really. I feel like people are much more nostalgic for Capcom, Konami, Sega, obviously Nintendo, but I never hear people waxing nostalgic about Data East. I will say I love their logo. I think it's a really cool logo. It's one of my favorite video game company logos. It just looks cool. It's a cool name, Data East. Like, if it was Sega, it would be called like Daia, you know, like Daea. But yeah, it's a shame. But let's take a look at some of their softography though on Sega Retro. They're all listed here. It's every game that Data East worked on that had some sort of tie to Sega. Either it was a Sega franchise that they developed a version of, or Sega hardware that they developed games for. I'm not going to read them all off, but you can see here a couple Mega Drive games.
Right.
Interestingly, Dash and Desperados is not mentioned.
Weird. Joe and Mac is pretty popular for...
It's up at the top, yeah. Joe and Mac, for sure. Two Crude Dudes. Only one Game Gear game in its side pocket, that one from the designer of Dash and Desperados. Couple Mega CD games, lots of Saturn. I feel like Saturn was, wow. And you mentioned Magical Drop, like that was their big franchise there. What is Magical Drop? What's that all about?
It's a puzzle game. You never played it?
I think I've played it, but it's just not. It doesn't stick out to me. Are there like memorable characters?
No, it's just or anything. It's just I used to play it. I used to play it.
Oh yes, it's like Columns from Above,
right?
Yeah, I think they did a Neo Geo Pocket Color version,
probably.
Yeah. They actually did a few Dreamcast games. They did Revive Susei. They did, which is, I don't know what that is. It's a sequel to a Saturn game that they did. Zombie Revenge, for whatever reason, they're credited.
As the port, making the port for the Dreamcast.
They developed the port of Zombie Revenge. That's interesting. I actually really like that game. And that's House of the Dead side story, basically.
Right.
And then they also did a golf game for the Dreamcast. So not too crazy, but they did kind of exist in those later days. And then there were some Super Hang-On port for the Amiga and Atari ST and IBM PC. So, you know, it's not nothing. Wish I could have seen more from Data East, but oh well, RIP Data East. George, now that we've concluded Dash and Desperados and Data East, what are we going to be talking about next time on Sega Talk?
We're going to be talking about a little game that has some green turtles that are teenagers and seem to know some karate in TMNT. Ooh. Hyperstone Heist. Is that the one we're talking about?
That's what we're talking about. Yeah, that's a Patreon pick.
And I swear I thought we covered that game before. Like, in my heart, I feel like we did, didn't we?
I looked it up and I don't think we did. And I'm thankful because, you know, we committed to it. So, it's a game we should have done. We never did, and I'm really excited to do it. Because, like I said, it's one of those... Just like how Dash and Desperados is our Patreon picker, Nicholas Schaefer's, like, game he grew up with. Hyperstone Heist is one of the, like, handful of five games that I was, like, go-to. Love it. So, looking forward to that, and we'll see you then on the all-new, all-positive, all-hyped Sega Talk.
Bye.
Bye. Bye! Bye! Ah! Right?
Right.
Okay, cool.